What does it feel like when your life shatters? Not the slow erosion of dissatisfaction, but the sudden, violent collapse of everything you thought was permanent. One day, you're making dinner for four, planning summer holidays, arguing about whose turn it is to do the school run. The next, you're standing in an empty house, wondering who you are without the scaffolding of we. This is the territory Rachel Cusk maps in Aftermath, not with comforting platitudes or redemptive arcs, but with the unflinching precision of someone documenting a disaster from the inside. The book caused a sensation when published, not because divorce is rare, but because Cusk refused to soften its edges. She wrote about the rage, the pettiness, the ways we weaponize our principles against each other. Zadie Smith called it unforgettable. Critics called it brave and brutal in equal measure. What makes it essential reading isn't just its honesty about marriage's end, but what it reveals about the stories we tell ourselves about partnership, gender, and identity. Stories that feel progressive until they trap us in new versions of old cages. Here's the irony: the progressive marriage that becomes its own prison. A couple rejects traditional roles. She earns the money, he manages home and children. Sounds enlightened, right? Except resentment doesn't care about your politics. It seeps in anyway. The problem wasn't the arrangement itself, but what it revealed. Dependence, financial, emotional, structural, carries the stain of powerlessness regardless of who occupies that position. Why did a man caring for his own children count as helping? Help implies the work belongs to someone else. The real revelation: our sense of worth gets tangled with economic power. Even when we consciously reject traditional values, they operate beneath the surface like underwater currents. The marriage became a hall of mirrors, each partner reflecting back the other's unexamined assumptions about value, contribution, and what makes a life legitimate. Sometimes the only way forward requires force. A dentist explains this while extracting a tooth with roots too twisted to save. Theoretically salvageable, but practically impossible. The metaphor lands with brutal clarity. Some things can't be gently coaxed apart. They must be wrenched free, and there will be blood. This is the part nobody tells you about major life changes. We prefer stories of conscious uncoupling and gentle evolution. But what happens when the only path out requires destruction, when kindness prolongs suffering? The dentist grips the tooth with steel pliers, pulling against soft tissue and bone. When it finally gives way, the chisel slips and damages healthy teeth above. Violence is unwieldy. There's always collateral damage. The physical pain mirrors the emotional surgery of separation. The crater left by an extracted tooth eventually becomes invisible from the outside, though your tongue never stops finding that absence. Other teeth shift to compensate, bearing weight they weren't designed to carry. The same happens with family, children, and friends adjusting to the new configuration, everyone learning to function around the hole where wholeness used to be. After separation, the world reorganizes into couples and everyone else. They're everywhere, kissing at traffic lights, walking synchronized, holding hands with casual confidence. Meanwhile, your house creaks with emptiness. The boiler breaks, a dark stain spreads across the kitchen wall like visible decay. You advertise the spare room and lonely men's circle, all carrying the specific loneliness of failed couplings. One moves in with his ironing board and humorous posters, his television standing like a vast, blinking god. The house that once held a family now shelters provisional arrangements. You've lost not just a person, but a story about who you are. Marriage provides narrative coherence. You're someone's partner, part of a recognized social unit. Outside, you're just yourself. Which sounds liberating until you realize how much of your identity was constructed through that reflection. Friends drift away, uncomfortable with your new status. You become an outsider, watching intact families move through their evening routines like actors in a play you've been expelled from. The cruelest part isn't what divorce does to you, it's watching it reshape your children. they develop a carefulness, a premature awareness of life's fragility. "I have two homes," your daughter announces with the precision of someone working out a difficult equation, "and I have no home." She's learned too young that the ground beneath your feet can open without warning. Social cruelty finds them too. Birthday parties where they're the only one not invited to sleep over. Best friends who suddenly demand exclusive loyalty or nothing. They read threat in kindness, their trust fractured along with the family structure. At dinner with a friend's intact family, they cling anxiously to you, then later admit, surprised, that they had fun, as though joy has become suspicious. Your daughters navigate a world that suddenly requires vigilance. They worry about getting fat while grief steals your appetite. Your clothes hang loose, pairing you with your daughters on the other side of what created them. The family table, once the heart of your home, now sits covered in papers and bills. The nourishing tree has been cut down. Recovery doesn't follow a straight line. You drive 45 minutes weekly to a therapist preaching psychoanalysis from his beige leather chair. His theories about transference feel academic and distant, technically correct, but fundamentally useless, offering frameworks when you need ground to stand on. Meanwhile, someone else appears. Let's call him Z. He arrives empty-handed but present, walking through countryside while discussing how narrative is the aftermath of violence. "The old story has to end before a new one can begin," he says, and this lands differently. Z fixes broken things around your house, opens ignored bills, reflects light like the sea even as winter darkens. He doesn't theorize about your pain, he simply shows up within it. This is what saves you. Not professional intervention, but human presence. Friends who bring lavender plants, who sit in the wreckage without rebuilding too quickly. The Greek chorus of community that bears witness, sharing grief's weight until it becomes bearable. Your worst experience brings out the best in others. This is civilization, the social fabric catching you when you fall. What remains after divorce isn't the marriage or who you were within it, but something harder to name, a self that exists without the validating mirror of partnership. It's terrifying and oddly freeing, like those enormous gilt hooks in your ceiling that once held an opera singer's hammock, expressing both threat and beauty. You buy a fern for your house, sexless, ancient, sensitive, yet remarkably resilient. These prehistoric survivors have outlasted empires and extinctions, furling and unfurling with changing conditions. You're learning the same survival skills, discovering that identity isn't fixed but fluid. The violence of extraction leaves a crater, but craters can become gardens. Your children develop resilience alongside loss. This isn't consolation. There's no redemptive arc that makes the pain worthwhile, but it is transformation. The old story ended. A new one, still being written, has begun. You're discovering you contain multitudes, not half of something broken, but whole unto yourself, like the earthworm that regenerates after being cut. The aftermath isn't just destruction. It's also, unexpectedly, a kind of birth.